Both of you have been here before. I've noticed that I haven't had any to say anyway. And so, I think we're introduced him with the topic for the evening, teaching the faith, matters and methods. I'd like to begin by saying thank you to the seminary, to Robert, and to the fellow of the students and faculty members who have come back twice and three times today. Thank you for the podium. Thank you for having a chance to say the things I really want to say, and for having another opportunity to say them here. I guess when I came this morning, I was a little frightened by the whole experience. I suspect that any teacher would be. But you've been kind and gracious, and I have appreciated very much the opportunity of being with you. I wouldn't want to pass up this opportunity without also saying thank you to the person who made these lectures possible. And though I cannot, in fact, name him, I would think that we would want to say to that person a gracious thank you for making this kind of activity possible. These lectures are, of course, in memoriam to our parish pastor and to a parish teacher. Just a few weeks from this night, we will have lectures on our campus, known as the Graduation Lectures in Education. The same donor provided funds for both series of lectures, and we are grateful to him. Teaching faith, models, and methods. This morning, we tried to develop a strategy for Christian education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I suggested that our future lay in the renewal of the parish as the primary educating agency of Christian nurture. Within that parish, I argued that our best hope for education of children was in the historical home church sphere synthesis. I tried to develop a clear statement for the value of the Christian day school as a vital mission in the contemporary church. At the same time, I understand clearly the need for a dramatic shift in emphasis upon adult education in early childhood education. Tonight our task is far more limited. I want to focus tonight on the Christian classroom and specifically on the act of teaching the faith. I will develop my remarks in two parts. The first consideration will deal with the past and present models used within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And second, I will attempt to underline some new models which might lead us into the future as we plan to teach the faith into the 70s and into the 80s. Models for teaching the faith. Models are useful symbols for approximating reality and making the kinds of observations and predictions that can lead to additional truth. Within the scientific realm, models are essential to make scientific predictions, determine practical applications, and narrow the realm of speculation. Models assist in designing interplanetary transportation systems and building technical machinery for communication, and in the creation of miracle machines to cure human illnesses. In the field of social sciences, models assist in community design and the development of therapy styles and in the cure of the human spirit. Within the realm of education, models serve as maps or guidelines for the practical task of classroom teaching. Model construction has become popular among social science educators, curriculum builders, and religious educators. Though I suspect that education models are far less sophisticated than their scientific counterparts, they do measure, limit, and approximate reality. And I would underline all of those. Measure, limit, and approximate reality. And sometimes they lead to useful application in the classroom. However, a serious word of caution needs to be stated early in our consideration this evening. There is not yet a precise science of education or of human relations. We simply do not have available a unified body of knowledge or a single theory in the field of human development or education. And naturally, many educators would dispute that statement, but the simple historical failure of our culture or of any culture to produce humane human beings gives ample evidence that we do not know how to educate a generation of truly warm, loving, productive people. That last statement may be more a statement of theological opinion than educational theory, but I believe believe it is simply rather an observable theory. What I shall now attempt to do is to construct a series of models that do convey approximate reality in the specific arena of teaching the faith. Some models used in our canonical history have been, I believe, timeless, if not heretical. They represent presuppositions which I believe to be false. Others are worth serious consideration and reflect the best of our theological and educational traditions. Finally, one or two are speculative. The task of model construction is useful and stimulating. Like a game, one can construct endless patterns of approximations to measure and limit truth. The hope I have for us this evening is that in this presentation we might be simulated together to our own individual model building. We need far more creativity in the construction of educational alternatives within the field. If we truly believe the gospel, then we might be more free to be more creative, teaching with ecstasy rather than with fear. And from my observation of recent classrooms across the Synod, we could do with a little more ecstasy, a little more celebration, if you will, a little more fun. So let's begin with model number one. Model number one is entitled Neo-Scholasticism and Early Lutheran Model. This model conveys what Walter Berman calls the classic Neo-Scholasticism syndrome of the Missouri Synod. Such a model might be characteristic of numerous teachers during the Synod's past. In my own doctoral dissertation on the theology and pedagogy of Paul E. Kretschmann, I believe that I have shown that the Kretschmann model for teaching religion was very similar to this presentation. The sequence is as follows. Given A priori, the inerrant, reliable, holy Bible, the book, B, one can believe the historical facts of that testimony, C, those facts, knowledge, create faith. They are believable because they are a priori truth. Therefore, D, one can believe what they say about salvation, and therefore one can come to faith in Jesus Christ. Such a model tends toward cognitive value, serving the taught abundant facts from the literary true books so that their faith will grow, more facts, more faith. Faith with faith in fact. Facts are truthful because the book is truthful, somehow reliable in a 20th century sense. And some of those facts dealt with the story of our redemption. They were reliable because they were from a true book. Thus the Christ event could be believed. You will recognize, I think, the unwritten real fundamentalistic approach. Wow, I didn't, that really looks so strong as you were reading. I qualified it. Sometimes such a method led to biblicism. Sometimes it led to dead orthodoxy, and sometimes the gospel was muted, and great concern was given to doctrine and false believers. This is not to make an unjust observation. There is surely the possibility that the gospel was conveyed through such a model. Many Lutherans who followed the outline were able to transcend its philosophical assumptions and gave witness to the true gospel message of God's love in Christ, this in spite of some faulty presuppositions. Model number two, scholastic objective. As a corollary to our first model, we can readily trace the development of religious objectives for the teaching of the faith in our past teaching. Teachers, pastors, Sunday school teachers were trained to develop objectives along these ideas. The base of the model is the same, correct knowledge, and the structure arises from that assumption. A, knowledge objectives were first and primary. Each lesson, biblical, centered on some cognitive goal, the facts of the lesson, the doctrine of the lesson, or the bias of the teacher, too often the latter. B, the idea was that correct knowledge would lead to a proper attitude. Thus, if one was sure that God does answer prayer, a student would naturally develop a careful attitude of the lesson was to manipulate the student to truth. A natural outgrowth of correct knowledge and correct attitude. I had heard, read, and done hundreds of these kinds of lesson plans. Office meetings, D.W.A. Taylor, Paul Reception, and a host of other giants in our history taught us decades of teaching methods firmly implanted in this model, a model that carries teachers far too often for use. The difficulty of the model, I think, is fairly clear. The assumption that we have absolute knowledge about anything except the gospel is, from my point, at least questionable. Secondly, attitudes do not necessarily flow from correct knowledge. Our experience and psychological experimentation indicate just the opposite. Often we feel the opposite attitude than the one taught by the teacher. Sometimes we're simply passive, especially when confronted with dull and unrelated facts. Sometimes we do the opposite of that which we know. Correct knowledge and good attitudes do not guarantee right action. It's the old word, the hell is paved with good intentions, sort of game. People who know better still hurt, still care, and still think. Finally, the model conveys again that knowledge, in fact, is really the top, the bottom, in this case, priority. I believe that these assumptions are at least questionable. Pedagogically, the model is weak in that it places almost all the burden of teaching and learning and planning on the teacher. The teacher, you see, writes the objective, molds the attitude, dictates the correct outcome for the lesson. The lesson, like the triangle, tends to narrow rather than to open youngsters up. They proceed to manipulate the outcome, so the outcome of each lesson aims at one thing, one skill, one act. The same, of course, for each and every child in the classroom. Now, such a method, I think you will agree, does not allow for individual difference, for creativity, or for the joyful response of abandon in response to the good word in Jesus Christ. Now, that model of objectives, I think, goes right together with the next model, which I will put on now, which followed those kinds of objectives. Model number three, the Darcy method. Educators in the Senate were able to adopt the best and secular method theory from the late 19th century American and German educators. The Bastian method was widespread in educational circles at the end of the century prior to the advent of modern psychology. The method was logically designed to communicate the factual basis of a discipline subject matter. The method fit the fanatical religion teaching that it says like a glove. He shows as well the inherent weaknesses of the model. The preparation step was designed to review and synthesize experiences which have been preceded in other lessons. The review is to draw together all facts that were learned before the immediate lesson. The presentation was teacher work, as was the preparation step. Careful logical outline of cognitive material was prepared. The teacher was again the crucial agent in the process. The lesson is his lesson. The presenting is his duty. The assimilation step is student work, a kind of a rehearsal, a review, or more often, a recitation of facts taught by the teacher. Out of that review, students are encouraged to draw logical conclusions or generalizations, and finally to make direct application to a real-life situation. Now, there's a danger involved for the educator to borrow one model from one discipline and use it in another. Ever since Dürer's process of education, educators have recognized that the discipline does in fact dictate the method, and I would like to underline Dürer's viewpoint. Thus, when theology or religion borrow from the sciences, the Hebraic teaching model, the inherent danger surface. The application step, a logical extension for factual lessons, could very easily become a matter of moralism. Every lesson could end with ought and should, and the source indicates that problem has its deep roots in the very pedagogy. It is natural, and it is easy to moralize. The method made the natural process even more accessible. A second weakness was the same as the previous model. The method tended to accent the cognitive development and the knowledge goals of the lesson. Finally, the model placed the teacher in the center of the process, making the teacher the key factor in success or failure. Such an authoritative lesson model fits Missouri Synod's theology well. Teachers pass on absolute truth by absolute method and set to know students by a predetermined application. Moralism is anti-gospel, and moralism became the benchmark of the Missouri Synod method of teaching the faith. Can you see these in that? Model number four, the religion portion. The textbooks for teaching the faith in the Missouri Synod have always been the Bible and the Catechism. Those two books form the basic curriculum for decades in synodical schools and Sunday schools. The model illustrated in the Bible reflects this pattern of curriculum in our past history. The Bible was singularly popular for teaching lower grades. We have always had a series of Bible story books for little people, continuing through the present even to now in the new textbook. Some doctrine, catechism, was taught in primary grade, but the major subject matter of teaching literate children was the Bible. As the child reached middle grade, the curriculum became increasingly catechetical. And by the time the youngster reached confirmation, the curriculum was entirely the small form catechism, usually taught without the Bible references at the bottom of the truth text. That's a shame, because had pastors started from the bottom up, that process might have even been changed too. Confirmation practices included a dogmatic catechism exam conducted with fervor before the entire congregation. Thus, children demonstrated to their parents the old answers, answers comfortable to the adults, so they were the same memory lessons that they had learned a decade or two earlier. Experience-based education, the hallmark of the progressive period, hardly touched the same, and certainly did not influence the teaching of religion. Our schools were always academically oriented. There was little progressive, permissive, or child-centered education going on in the Synod. So while religious educators in American Protestantism were enamored with experience as the basis for teaching the faith, Missouri held faithful to teaching the Catechism and the Bible. In one sense, not a bad idea at all. The model indicates, however, our priority. It indicates also our presupposition, that theology is built on the Bible first and the Catechism second. And finally, the model was entirely cognitive. It had to do with ensuring that Bible and Catechism facts would remain each decade the heart of Missouri, the children. Weaknesses in the model are more apparent, I believe, today than they were a decade or two past. Due to the work of T.J. and Ronald Goldman, we are far more able to assess the success or failure of such a method. We know, for instance, that children cannot handle intellectual abstraction so early. They cannot think historically much before fourth or fifth grade. We also know from historical scholarship and biblical criticism that the Bible is a very difficult adult book, written by and for adults. On the basis of those kinds of insights, the model must be judged seriously as a mistake and as an inappropriate way to teach mature Christian faith. The method, I think, managed to lock listening adults into their child view of Scripture. It arrested the mature faith of countless Christians by too early literalizing images and metaphors, which had to do with significant abstraction rather than pure literalism. I believe it assisted in developing what we call the confirmation complex, the notion that one learned the faith factually stems from this idea. The model tended to oversimplify the biblical method and introduce systematic theology, I think, too early. Systematics has to do with serious, difficult adult interaction. Bible study has to do with mature adult work. By introducing both systematics and Bible study too early in the life of the student, I believe that we have nurtured simplistic notions about faith, not at all the same kind of faith as childlike faith. I could amplify a lot about that. I think much of the problem with contemporary lay theology in the Synod is precisely because matters we learn too early. And we locked ourselves into imagery and into concepts that were accepted as literalism. And then later on, we found out that there were metaphors, abstractions of a different kind of reality. And I think that we are reaping the harvest again of what in fact we have taught. Model number five, the exegesis of life. The model is an attempt to teach the faith as a Lutheran worldview, as a Lutheran with structured reality. The model suggests the world as it is, filled with the results of death, all kinds of death symptoms, assorted kinds of bad news which seem to press in upon us. God's judgment is alive in the real world. There is no escape. What we have is life is really death, and there is a sure end for everyone, a dead end. The best hidden, don't laugh. The best hidden secret, or maybe you can know. The best hidden secret in America, Margaret Mead says, is death. Grief therapists replace funeral directors. Wakes are no longer in the family home, but are conducted antiseptically in funeral parlors. The grass at the cemetery is stony. We don't even die, we pass on. Or, as the AAR insurance salesman would have it, something happens to us. The reality that we all want to escape is written all over all of life. It is death, one petition. Teaching the faith by this model helps young children acknowledge the truth of God's no. His judgment against us, built into the very structure of human existence. To say yes to that kind of a reality is to have been confronted with the reality of the love of God acted out in the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus. For the good news is better than the bad news. The yes is greater than the no. Christ overcomes death in the midst. But that reality is not discovered, it is proclaimed. It, in a sense, is a transcendent reality, or as Abraham would have it, a world event. As we teach life, as we acknowledge the charisma, we announce it by Bible story, we rehearse it by God's acts in our church history, and we summon faith by the spoken word and by the mercy of our own words and our own faith. The model implies that this kind of teaching begins from the bottom up, naturally, and naturally leads from the bottom up to a dead end. That's good Lutheran theology. The gospel then is announced, and it is acted out in the midst of death. The experience of Jesus is always now and not yet. It is always experiential, yet it is more than experiential. We point to the symptoms of his love in life. We see his movement in his feet, in Martin Luther King, in Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and another great man of faith. But we remember, as Sirlight Arthur Miller reminds us, that whoever goes to serve another person with the promise of limitless love throws a shadow on the face of God. And so we point beyond human experience to the experience of hope. We act out this hope with children in the witness of worship, in the witness of bread and wine and milk and cookies. As we say his name and announce his love, we act out forgiveness, but we say the words as well. So we remember that the reality of God is always masked in the midst of our best attempts, in the very words that we call the foolishness of speaking. What I've tried to suggest here is that teaching the faith is really all about introducing youngsters to life, to the experience of God's judgment and of God's mercy, as it's acted out in all of the world, in all of the experiences of the classroom, in all of the lives of the youngsters. Model number six, the cycle of redemption. Those of you who have read my Teaching Religion on Edge of the 70s are acquainted with this model. The farm is borrowed from pastoral counseling. Dr. James Arrested first proposed this model as a useful way to indicate the normal sequence of breathing persons in a small breath good group. I've adapted the model to illustrate the reality that occurs as we teach the word stop. The first step crisis begins the process. We pose a problem, we set the stage for the lesson, and we begin the process of law, exposure. Theologically, the opening of the lesson announces experientially the knowledge of God's word. Pedagogically, the step is teacher-pupil work. The teacher sets out the problem or the barrier so that the students can become immediately involved in the process. Ideally, the approach is dialogue between children and teachers. The more participation, the better the process. The model assumes one position of learning theory. That is, to learn, there must be an unknown, a conflict, a little trauma. The more significant the trauma, the more significant is the possibility for a significant learning experience. Step two is teacher work. The teacher has the task of adding data, of taking a slice of life and presenting some data about that part of life. The presentation is a story, a picture, a play, a record, a film, or an activity. The attempt like that of the good playwright is to pose a situation and to tell the truth about part of human existence. The teacher's task is to provide enough data to initiate interest and allow discussion and conclusion. The data should be a word of God. If it is a word about reality, it will also be a word of God. The lesson in the model tends to amplify the crisis and leads to deeper understanding of the peril of life itself. Step three is pupil work under the Spirit. There is dialogue and discussion around the data provided earlier. The teacher steps out of the center and sits on the side in the circle with the student. Now there are no experts, for all are sharing the experience of faith. Hopefully, by careful questioning and quiet patience, the teacher leads the students to deeper insights into the experience. The children are encouraged to openness and sharing. In a classroom where youngsters know and trust each other, the discussion can often lead to confession and healing. Children can admit their fears and faith and do words of forgiveness. This is no exercise, I think, in sensitivity training. Rather, it is an experience in the Christian life. Step four leads to the response. The activity is also pupil activity. The teacher will listen for directives that the pupil, that the children told. There is no single good response for the good news. The teacher allows and encourages latitude in response. A group of children may want to write a liturgy. They may want to make a collage. They may want to visit a home for the aged. The style of the teacher in the classroom must be open enough to allow all of those different kinds of responses. Pre-planned teacher responses are not appropriate. The response to forgiveness and hope is spontaneity and joy. Song, celebration, and singing are moments of happening for the Christian classroom. Dancing God in Lutheran classrooms, then the time to join his dance is certainly in the response to the good news in Jesus Christ. The experience of yes in the no leads to freedom. The end of the lesson is unpredictable. Now, I recognize weaknesses in this model. As in all models, the model, I think, can become repetitive, it can become kind of a forced daily pattern, or the model can become contrived and meaningless. Crisis may be phony, and the teaching may become unconcerned about reality. I suspect that the model best illustrates the spontaneous events of confession and absolution that occur in the daily life of children with their teachers. Yet most teachers, and I include myself, are uncomfortable in allowing the teaching of the faith to be accidental. Care must be taken to plan from the life experience of the class and build crises and cure on the basis of one's communal life with the youngsters. Before one can teach a person, one must know that person. I value this model for leading new teachers into a format of teaching the faith, concentrating on a theology of forgiveness rather than cognitive values. I believe the model is especially useful for Sunday school teachers. Teachers can develop the simple lesson plan weekly, and it seems to serve as a corrective to our natural tendency to dogmatize and moralize.
good set of goal malady rescue objectives after the Kemmerer model, the approach seems to help the student focus their teaching on the task of doing the Word of God, not just to review the facts and stories. Model number 7, a parish curriculum design. In contrast to the model presented before, which represented our current practice, or part of our current practice, I propose that the above is a better curriculum pattern for parish education. Jesus, it is said, played with children and taught adults, and I think that's more than a truism. The model develops religion lessons out of the life experience during those early years, introducing only carefully selected Bible narratives. During the middle grade, the Bible is introduced in increasing proportion until confirmation or eighth grade. The work of Hugh Day, of Bruner, of Goldman, and others indicates that this pattern is more in keeping with the developmental pattern of children. Upper grade children ought not to be denied the excitement of serious Bible exposition. They are capable, I believe, of developing skills in Bible study and understanding even some of the difficulties with the textual material. Systematic theology, I think, ought to be reserved for secondary education and adult activities. For systematic theology is really a matter of mature thought about the faith. Finally, adult education is best taught, I think, around topics and life, those that are of interest to the membership of the parish, in dialogue with the biblical tradition. The experience raises the religious question. The tradition, church Bible history, is placed in tension with what is. This inductive method, I believe, is superior to the older pattern of commentary Bible study of previous generations. It also assumes that laymen can teach the faith in the context of his life. If the data is to be only Bible study, then perhaps the pastor, the expert, ought to really be doing the teaching. But if the data is to be life, if the data is to be life as adults living, then we must allow Christians under the Spirit. We must be able to make the confession that they too are able to exegete life and sort out God's signs of his bad news and his good news. We trust that they can share as mature Christians, that they can share Christian doubt and faith and express mutual consolation and comfort. Pastors and teachers do not have to lead every nurturing effort of every congregation meeting. If we trust the Christian experience, we must be free to let it happen. Now, other models need to be constructed, and I'm presently struggling with the practice of the Eucharist as a model for children's education in church and in the home. As we move to early communion practices, we need to think through the impact of the Eucharist for new patterns of parish education. The practice of doing the Eucharist, I think, is almost non-cognitive. It is very much a matter of eating and drinking. All the very good experiences of little children, eating and drinking. I do not yet have a visual image or a clear picture of the practice of the sacrament in our parish education life. I feel that it might change all of our patterns of parish education. Our own family experience with the Eucharist has been exciting, and has brought just a host of new problems and blessings. I suspect the place of the sacrament in our education practice raises also the role of the teacher as celibate, and the place of the home as possible house church setting for such nurturing. My colleague Walter Bowman seems to suggest that the pattern of home Eucharist is open to creative experiments, even within our present polity practices. But that arena needs serious study. I don't know what else to say about that, except it seems to me that if we are going to administer the Eucharist, if we're going to celebrate the Eucharist with children, we're going to have to modify many of our educational practices. And I haven't really thought through what kind of impact that's going to have in a parish educational program, or for that matter, with parish education materials. Nor have I dealt this evening with the matter of teacher questions. And I suppose that's the whole lecture in itself. There is research and model work available in the area of question technique. We can become more sophisticated and thoughtful about process. I acknowledge the value of question technique and teacher effectiveness research, but my own priorities remain that teaching is more art than science. I believe teaching the faith is more an act of the Spirit than a program response. Technique is secondary to hearing the good news in Jesus. Method opposed to it. Much of what one can say about methods of teaching the faith has been present in the discussion of the model. I wish only to highlight a few motifs which are important regardless of which model one chooses to follow. A, structure the environment. Implicit in my remarks this morning was the idea that all of the parish is an environment that does educate. Nothing happens in a classroom or a school that is not surrounded by what one author calls the hidden curriculum. The hidden curriculum of the parish school or the Sunday school classroom is the lifestyle of the parish environment. That environment may be repressive, narrow, constricting, or it may be nurturing, or the business, healing, and stimulating. And I would just add that if there's anything that I feel sensitive as a teacher in the church today about regarding the contemporary problems we're having with neo-theological discussion, is the fact that that has created, I think, a climate within Missouri which is alien to good education. Because good education means risk. It means openness, it means trust, it means honesty. And those are commodities which I think are hard to come by presently in Missouri. So the sooner we can be about our business, the better it will be for the education of the kids. The classroom here is a specific environment. We can take a cue from George Leonard in his recent book, Education and Ecstasy. The environment of the learning situation is the teacher. The environment is the teacher. The medium is the method. We choose our educational position, our methods, and we structure the environment accordingly. We arrange the room, row by row or cluster by cluster. Our bulletin boards reflect our values. The desks and the materials all structure learning. What we say or do is either negated or reinforced by the learning environment. I'm reminded of a unit I observed in social studies last year, a lesson on brotherhood in a Lutheran school. Nowhere in the entire school was there a single picture of persons, black, brown, red, or yellow. The world of the school was white. The discussion was about integration. The environment spoke one lesson, and the teacher spoke another. The result could only be confusion for the youngsters. We structure for decision. We structure for discussion. We structure for equality or for dogmatism. And for absolute teacher dominance. I muse about the construction of River Forest classrooms in 1921, with the raised platforms in front and the heavy oak desks separating teachers from students at a lower level, incidentally. I can't help but wonder about the symbolic value of pulpits, raised or flat, or altar rails separating clergy from laity, or laymen always kneeling for communion, gazing up at that figure dressed in large white flowing robes. I wonder, and I suspect that we teach a great deal more about deference and dogmatism, as well as paternalism and authoritarianism by our hidden culture. But before there can be any act of shared confession or absolution, before any of that can happen, the class must trust. Build trust and then teach what you will. If our students trust each other and us, they can open to each other. My view of the parish classroom is that of a miniature church. The classroom can reflect a trusting climate where sin can be open, acted, and forgiven. And how does one teach trust? First, I believe by being what we are. As a teacher becomes more trustworthy, more whole in her being, she will generate more trust from her youngsters. The first step to trust in the classroom is a healthy trust in teacher, one who has come to trust herself. Much of what I have said about teacher identity this morning and this afternoon is applicable here. Teachers who are secure in their being are better trusting teachers. Clear professional and personal identity are essential to healthy teachers. Most teachers are relatively healthy and need encouragement to risk and fear. As teachers reveal their inner selves to students, as CDs then are more encouraged to honesty. We can do many things for each other as staff, pastors, and teachers. Trust is built on shared experience. As we become more open to ourselves and to each other, our classrooms can become more like what they ought to be. The implication for teacher education, I think, is apparent. We need far more experience and skill in human relationships and group interaction. We've just recently adopted a whole new curriculum at River Forest, and no place in that required curriculum for teacher education does a student have a chance to be in a class that is absolutely, totally group-oriented, or whatever kinds of cliches or terms you'd like to use to describe that experience. I think we need to build some of those in into our teacher training and to our professors. Relationship. Mutuality is a key word about relationship in the parish classroom. We are all equal as human sinful persons. We cannot lord it over each other when the only gift that we have to share is always a gift. Yet exclusive mutuality is a myth for the teacher. As Martin Luther so correctly points out, the teacher is always one with the student, but always shares with intentionality. He stands over against the student as one who brings to the relationship a special intention, the healing or the education of the student. Luther's words are helpful. We are not children, first. We are teachers. The office of the teacher places us in a relationship of trust and intention. Like a good therapist, the teacher cannot allow himself or herself the privilege of patience with his student. The relationship is one of informer, of resource catalyst, approachability, cordiality, and warmth. Yet in that relationship, the teacher stands objectively with intention, or else the relationship can deteriorate into that of brother, friend, buddy, or the possibility then for education is really placed in jeopardy. Material. The materials for teaching the faith are part of the method. I have said before that I believe that the chief tools for teaching the faith are the Bible, the hymnal, the world, and the participants. I harbor mistrust. It's just a little hard tonight. Gentlemen, no, I just was going with it. Some of my best friends work for the Board for Parish Education. I'll just go on. I harbor mistrust for other materials, even the most creative and the best constructed. Mission Life is obviously the best curriculum developed by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but it remains a tool in our craft and not an end in itself. All published materials suffer, I think, from some important limitations. Number one, they tend to hinder creativity and innovation by the class and the teacher. Number two, they cannot be written for specific circumstances for every parish. And number three, they remain guidelines, sometimes limiting rather than enhancing good teaching. I suppose we will need to use materials for some years to come. Publishing houses need to exist, and might as well read what I've written. And the religious education materials are big business, even at CPA. My view is, of course, somewhat negative to program curriculum mass produced. The best materials will grow like good music out of the real situation. There is no mass producible law gospel answer for each specific congregation or person. There is no catechism of correct responses. The good news must be targeted, as Dr. Kemmer so aptly tells us, into the real lives of youngsters. Materials are only tools to help us get acquainted with the child. I would recommend a minimum of canned materials. If teachers have time and assistance from professional teachers, they can develop their own lessons. Far too much teaching of the faith is still plastic and glossy, more gimmick and glitter than the reality of real life. I'm suggesting a moratorium on packets of stuff and a good deal more time spent on serious Bible studies and serious attention to the events of modern history, generally and specifically. Whatever materials we use, we need to review them carefully. Do they really convey the good news? The silent symbols of white faces, of middle-class housing, of smiling, blue-eyed, blonde-haired children betray a culture capturing the truth of the world. A caution then is in order, use only as few materials as possible and attempt to seek out those materials which do really approximate reality. Avoid the multimedia clutter and the polished new package. Life is not all that cheap and certainly not packaged that well. Keep life as realistically as you can. In summary, the method of teaching the faith is not unrelated from living life. As our classrooms become spaces where open inquiry happens, they can become temples of His Word. The good news turns the death of life to life in death and gives us participation.
Why these has ended like a sermon. You know, I feel like saying amen. I've got a minute. Can we, by agreement, extend that questioning time to at least 15 minutes? Say, bring that time to at least 10:09. And I suppose if any of you feel that you really have to leave, why then? You obviously are free to do so. We aren't oppressive around here. Okay. We'll just ask you to field the question.
Who wants to begin? Yes, Mr. Clint.
I have a question to you on your model. Now, I think that towards the end of your commentary, you said some things which may not be altogether in line with your model. My question is this. If you have a teacher with a deep faith who is a genuine Romanian, who has good personal relations with his father, who is knowledgeable, and who is able to communicate and to stimulate communication, what difference does the model make?
The question is, if you have a teacher who's warm, approachable, fairly knowledgeable, then what difference does the model make? I suppose that my viewpoint would be that regardless of how good the teacher is, that he better be very careful when he introduces biblical literature to very little children. Simply because the biblical metaphor, the problem of the various kinds of genre, the difficulties of some of the language, the problem with all of the various kinds of literature within the Bible are very difficult for a child to assimilate small talk. And I wonder whether immediately we don't risk the possibility, well, I think we do, that a child will interpret that data the same way in which he sees a car accident and comes home and says, I saw an accident. And I think that most biblical scholars, most biblical theologians will agree that I think there are degrees and levels of material which are understandable and which are available to the apprehension of the children. The stories that I think we should deal with little children would be the stories that have stories about brothers and sisters, sibling rivalry, stories about mothers and fathers, stories about hating and loving. You know, those are things that kids can experience. And we want to try, I think, to relate those kinds of stories into the lives of youngsters. But I think we have to be careful that we grade the Bible material to the age level of the class. So in that case, even if you are very perceptive and good teacher, I think one has to be very careful. Incidentally, this is not saying anything very liberal or very radical. That is, in fact, what the very Synod has done for a couple of generations. We've always had Bible stories. In the very common. We don't touch the host of stories in our Bible history books. You go back and look over those Bible history books, and which part of the Bible is omitted. So we really, in one sense, and already developed our own kind of children. Mr. Yes?
And that's a good question. I think, you know, the story just not well common for general people. All the time. Sodom and Gomorrah was the first story. Now, I think even my Lord had a little trouble with getting the Sodom and Gomorrah over there.
I'm not sure I understand
idea. Some of the religions have their years of a period of time, years on the modified,
if a parish can do this, I think, you know, that parish will make some real strides. I think I could have said a lot more about these ages down here. Dr. Bowman says we do promiscuous baptism in the very center, which means that we really don't do much nurturing or take much nurturing care during those early years. I think that's one area that I haven't thought much about. And another area is this area in terms of parental training. I suspect that if we could build a new kind of society, we would probably revert back to a very conservative model. We would provide parents who would be the nurturing agents for their children. But given the limits of our contemporary kind of society, I think we're stuck with other institutions to do that work. I think, therefore, I would want to modify adult education to have far more time